The Novels of Charles Dickens. An Introduction. Written by David Timpson. Read by Neville Jason. Our Mutual Friend. Dickens wrote Our Mutual Friend in 1865, and it was to be his last completed novel. Even at the end of his career, Dickens was still seeking to be innovative, and in this novel copies the style of his young friend Wilkie Collins, who had made a name for himself as a writer of sensation novels. The Woman in White by Collins had been serialized by Dickens in All the Year Round and was considered to be the novel of the year when it was published in 1860. Sensation novels involve plots full of mystery and intrigue. And in Our Mutual Friend, Dickens developed a sensational plot concerning a young man reported to have died by drowning. Dickens's own life at this time was cloaked in mystery and enigma in order to keep his affair with the young actress Ellen Ternan a secret from his adoring public. In Our Mutual Friend, Dickens continues with the social message he had begun in Bleak House in 1853, where he expressed the need for poverty and disease to be eradicated once and for all by improved sanitary conditions. The image of the River Thames runs through the novel, but water, usually regarded as a source of life, is here corrupted by man's abuses, by corpses and the detritus that lives off its pollution, such as Gaffer Hexham and Rogue Riderhood. The novel's prevailing images are of dust, dirt, and waste products, out of which the poor continue to make a living. The image of waste or rubbish is echoed in the occupations of the lower classes depicted in the novel. Wegg, the seller of ballads full of romantic rubbish no one wants, Jenny Wren, the maker of dolls, useless fripperies no one seems to buy, Venus, the articulator of dead bones for no established purpose, and the ultimate occupation that makes something out of nothing, the sifter of other people's cast-offs, the dustman, Boffin. Henry Mayhew's monumental London Labour and the London Poor had been published in 1861-2. One of Mayhew's articles was on the dust contractors who recovered London's refuse. He quotes the official figures of 3,500,000 tons of coal per year being consumed, and implies that if the ashes and cinders weren't removed, London would be overwhelmed with dust. Thus, by providing a very necessary service, dust contractors made a considerable fortune, amounting in some cases to as much as £40,000. By its association, therefore, money is presented as contaminated with dirt. Money in this novel equals dust. Those who have money in any quantity are presented as worthless, indolent, self-obsessed types, the Veneerings, the Podsnaps, Eugene Wrayburn, or young Charlie Hexham, who only sees in his education a means to escape from poverty and join the economic rat race. Money worship was to Dickens a form of life in death, and death lies like a heavy pall over this story. From the corpse in the first chapter, the novel is never far away from the images of mortality and the inevitable return of mankind to dust. The morbid elements in this novel may be due to Dickens's own near encounter with death whilst writing it. Having had a break on the continent for his nerves, Dickens was involved in his return journey by train in an accident at Staplehurst in Kent. His train was derailed whilst travelling over a viaduct. 10 passengers were killed and 40 seriously injured. Dickens heroically helped to rescue and comfort the injured, and risking his own life, recovered from the shattered carriage he had been occupying, the episode of Our Mutual Friend he had been writing. He had rescued Ellen Ternan, too, who had been with him in the carriage. Ellen, a shadowy figure, seems not to have responded to Dickens as he would have wished. She was, after all, only 26, and he was 53. The romance of Bella Wilther and Rokesmith in Our Mutual Friend may perhaps reflect the progress or otherwise of Dickens's own love affair. The successful conclusion of the romance, and Dickens somewhat obsessively dwelling on the details of the developing intimacy between Bella and John, may represent a large dose of wishful thinking on the author's part. Likewise, the other romantic thread of the novel, where a fine gentleman, Eugene Wrayburn, is irresistibly drawn to a working-class girl, Lizzie Hexham, may be a personal fantasy for Dickens. As he puts it in Book 4 of this novel, "Oh, what a bright old song it is, that, oh, 'tis love, 'tis love, 'tis love, that makes the world go round."
The River Thames and Pollution. In these times of ours, though concerning the exact year there is no need to be precise, a boat of dirty and disreputable appearance, with two figures in it, floated on the Thames between Southwark Bridge, which is of iron, and London Bridge, which is of stone, as an autumn evening was closing in. The figures in this boat were those of a strong man, with ragged, grizzled hair and a sun-browned face, and a dark girl of 19 or 20, sufficiently like him to be recognisable as his daughter. The girl rowed, pulling a pair of sculls very easily. The man, with the rudder line slack in his hands and his hands loose in his waistband, kept an eager lookout. He had no net, hook or line, and he could not be a fisherman. His boat had no cushion for a sitter, no paint, no inscription, no appliance beyond a rusty boat-hook and a coil of rope, and he could not be a waterman. His boat was too crazy and too small to take in a cargo for delivery, and he could not be a lighterman or river carrier. There was no clue to what he looked for. But he looked for something, with a most intent and searching gaze. The tide, which had turned an hour before, was running down, and his eyes watched every little race and eddy in its broad sweep as the boat made slight headway against it, or drove stern foremost before it, according as he directed his daughter by a movement of his head. She watched his face as earnestly as he watched the river. But in the intensity of her look, there was a touch of dread or horror. Allied to the bottom of the river rather than the surface, by reason of the slime and ooze with which it was covered, and its sodden state, this boat and the two figures in it obviously were doing something that they often did, and were seeking what they often sought. Half savage as the man showed, with no covering on his matted head, with his brown arms bare to between the elbow and the shoulder, with the loose knot of a looser kerchief lying low on his bare breast in a wilderness of beard and whisker, with such dress as he wore seeming to be made out of the mud that begrimed his boat, still there was businesslike usage in his steady gaze. So with every lithe action of the girl, with every turn of her wrist, perhaps most of all with her look of dread or horror, they were things of usage.
"Keep her out, Lizzie. Tide runs strong here. Keep her well afore the sweep of it."
Trusting to the girl's skill, and making no use of the rudder, he eyed the coming tide with an absorbed attention. So the girl eyed him. But it happened now that a slant of light from the setting sun glanced into the bottom of the boat, and, touching a rotten stain there which bore some resemblance to the outline of a muffled human form, coloured it as though with diluted blood. This caught the girl's eye, and she shivered.
"What ails you?"
said the man, immediately aware of it, though so intent on the advancing waters.
"I see nothing afloat."
The red light was gone, the shudder was gone, and his gaze, which had come back to the boat for a moment, travelled away again. Wheresoever the strong tide met with an impediment, his gaze paused for an instant. At every mooring chain and rope, at every stationary boat or barge that split the current into a broad arrowhead, at the offsets from the piers of Southwark Bridge, at the paddles of the river steamboats as they beat the filthy water, at the floating logs of timber lashed together lying off certain wharves,
his shining eyes darted a hungry look. After a darkening hour or so, suddenly the rudder lines tightened in his hold, and he steered hard towards the Surrey shore. Always watching his face, the girl instantly answered to the action in her sculling. Presently the boat swung round, quivered as from a sudden jerk, and the upper half of the man was stretched out over the stern. The girl pulled the hood of a cloak she wore over her head and over her face, and, looking backwards so that the front folds of this hood were turned down the river, kept the boat in that direction going before the tide. Until now the boat had barely held her own, and had hovered about one spot. But now the banks changed swiftly, and the deepening shadows and the kindling lights of London Bridge were past, and the tiers of shipping lay on either hand. It was not until now that the upper half of the man came back into the boat. His arms were wet and dirty, and he washed them over the side. In his right hand he held something, and he washed that in the river too. It was money. He chinked it once, and he blew upon it once, and he spat upon it once.
"For luck," he hoarsely said, before he put it in his pocket. "Lizzie!"
The girl turned her face towards him with a start, and rowed in silence. Her face was very pale. He was a hook-nosed man, and with that and his bright eyes and his ruffled head, bore a certain likeness to a roused bird of prey.
"Take that thing off your face."
She put it back.
"Here, and give me hold of the scows. I'll take the rest of the spill."
"No, no, father, no. I can't indeed, father. I cannot sit so near it."
He was moving towards her to change places, but her terrified expostulation stopped him, and he resumed his seat.
"What hurt can it do you?"
"None, none. But I cannot bear it."
"Is my belief you hate the sight of the very river?"
I do not like it, father."
"As if it wasn't your living. As if it wasn't meat and drink to you."
At these latter words the girl shivered again, and for a moment paused in her rowing, seeming to turn deadly faint. It escaped his attention, for he was glancing over the stern at something the boat had in tow.
Silas Wegg reads to Mr. Boffin.
"So now, Wegg," said Mr. Boffin, wiping his mouth with an air of much refreshment, "you begin to know us as we are. This is a charming spot, is the Bower, but you must get to appreciate it by degrees. It's a spot to find out the merits of little by little, and a new one every day. There's a serpentining walk up each of the mounds that gives you the yard and neighbourhood changing every moment. When you get to the top, there's a view of the neighbouring premises, not to be surpassed. The premises of Mrs. Boffin's late father, canine provision trade, you look down into as if they was your own. And the top of the high mound is crowned with a latticework arbour, in which, if you don't read out loud many a book in the summer, aye, and as a friend, drop many a time into poetry too, it shan't be my fault. Now, what'll you read on?"
"Thank you, sir," returned Wegg, as if there were nothing new in his reading at all. "I generally do it on gin and water."
"Keeps the organ moist, does it, Wegg?"
asked Mr. Boffin with innocent eagerness.
"No, sir," replied Wegg coolly. "I should hardly describe it so, sir. I should say mellers it. Mellers it is the word I should employ, Mr. Boffin."
His wooden conceit and craft kept exact pace with the delighted expectation of his victim. The visions rising before his mercenary mind of the many ways in which this connection was to be turned to account never obscured the foremost idea natural to a dull, overreaching man, that he must not make himself too cheap. Mrs. Boffin's fashion, as a less inexorable deity than the idol usually worshipped under that name, did not forbid her mixing for her literary guest, or asking if he found the result to his liking. On his returning a gracious answer and taking his place at the literary settle, Mr. Boffin began to compose himself as a listener at the opposite settle with exultant eyes.
"Sorry to deprive you of a pipe, Wegg," he said, filling his own, "but you can't do both together. Oh, and another thing I forgot to name. When you come in here of an evening and look round you and notice anything on a shelf that happens to catch your fancy, mention it."
Wegg, who had been going to put on his spectacles, immediately laid them down with the sprightly observation,
"You read my thoughts, sir. Do my eyes deceive me, or is that object up there a pie? It can't be a pie."
"Yes, it's a pie, Wegg," replied Mr. Boffin with a glance of some little discomfiture at the decline and fall.
"Have I lost my smell for fruits, or is it a apple pie, sir?" asked Wegg.
"It's a veal and ham pie," said Mr. Boffin.
"Is it indeed, sir? And it would be hard, sir, to name the pie that is a better pie than a wheel and hammer," said Mr. Wegg, nodding his head emotionally.
"Have some, Wegg."
"Thank you, Mr. Boffin. I think I will, at your invitation. I wouldn't at any other parties at the present juncture, but at yours, sir. And meaty jelly, too, especially when a little salt, which is the case where there's ham, is mellowing to the organ, is very mellowing to the organ."
Mr. Wegg did not say what organ, but spoke with a cheerful generality. So the pie was brought down, and the worthy Mr. Boffin exercised his patience until Wegg, in the exercise of his knife and fork, had finished the dish, only profiting by the opportunity to inform Wegg that although it was not strictly fashionable to keep the contents of a larder thus exposed to view, he, Mr. Boffin, considered it hospitable, for the reason that instead of saying in a comparatively unmeaning manner to a visitor,
"There are such and such edibles downstairs, will you have anything up?"
you took the bold, practical course of saying,
"Cast your eye along the shelves, and if you see anything you like there, have it down."
And now Mr. Wegg at length pushed away his plate and put on his spectacles, and Mr. Boffin lighted his pipe and looked with beaming eyes into the opening world before him. And Mrs. Boffin reclined in a fashionable manner on her sofa, as one who would be part of the audience if she found she could, and would go to sleep if she found she couldn't.
"Ahem," began Wegg. "This, Mr. Boffin and lady, is the first chapter of the first volume of The Decline and Fall Off."
Here he looked hard at the book and stopped.
"What's the matter, Wegg?"
"Why, it comes into my mind, sir. Do you know, sir," said Wegg, with an air of insinuating frankness, having first again looked hard at the book, "that you made a little mistake this morning, which I had meant to set you right in, only something put it out of my head. I think you said Rooshan Empire, sir."
"It is Rooshan, ain't it, Wegg?"
"No, sir. Roman. Roman."
"What's the difference, Wegg?"
"The difference, sir?"
Mr. Wegg was faltering and in danger of breaking down, when a bright thought flashed upon him.
"The difference, sir? There you place me in a difficulty, Mr. Boffin. Suffice it to observe that the difference is best postponed to some other occasion when Mrs. Boffin does not honour us with her company. In Mrs. Boffin's presence, sir, we had better drop it."
Mr. Wegg thus came out of his disadvantage with quite a chivalrous air, and not only that, but by dint of repeating with a manly delicacy,
"In Mrs. Boffin's presence, sir, we had better drop it,"
turned the disadvantage on Boffin, who felt that he had committed himself in a very painful manner.
Mr. Podsnap and the Foreigner.
The majority of the guests were like the plate, and included several heavy articles, weighing ever so much. But there was a foreign gentleman among them, whom Mr. Podsnap had invited after much debate with himself, believing the whole European continent to be in mortal alliance against the young person.
And there was a droll disposition, not only on the part of Mr. Podsnap, but of everybody else, to treat him as if he were a child who was hard of hearing. As a delicate concession to this unfortunately born foreigner, Mr. Podsnap, in receiving him, had presented his wife as Madame Podsnap, also his daughter as Mademoiselle Podsnap, with some inclination to add Ma Fee, in which bold venture, however, he checked himself. The Veneerings, being at that time the only other arrivals, he added, in a condescendingly explanatory manner, Monsieur Veneering, and then subsided into English.
How do you like London? Mr. Podsnap now inquired from his station of host, as if he were administering something in the nature of a powder or potion to the deaf child. London! Londra! London!
The foreign gentleman admired it.
You find it very large, said Mr. Podsnap, spaciously.
The foreign gentleman found it very large.
And very rich.
The foreign gentleman found it, without doubt, énormément riche.
Enormously rich, we say, returned Mr. Podsnap in a condescending manner. Our English adverbs do not terminate in mong, and we pronounce the ch as if there were a t before it. We say rich.
Rich, remarked the foreign gentleman.
And do you find, sir, pursued Mr. Podsnap with dignity, many evidences that strike you of our British constitution in the streets of the world's metropolis, London, Londra, London?
The foreign gentleman begged to be pardoned, but did not altogether understand.
The Constitution Britannique, Mr. Podsnap explained, as if he were teaching in an infant school. We say British, but you say Britannique, you know, forgivingly, as if that were not his fault. The Constitution, sir?
The foreign gentleman said,
May yes, I know him.
A youngish, sallowish gentleman in spectacles, with a lumpy forehead, seated in a supplementary chair at a corner of the table, here caused a profound sensation by saying in a raised voice,
Esca,
and then stopping dead.
Mais oui, said the foreign gentleman, turning towards him. Esque, quoi donc?
But the gentleman with the lumpy forehead, having for the time delivered himself of all that he found behind his lumps, spake for the time no more.
I was inquiring, said Mr. Podsnap, resuming the thread of his discourse, whether you have observed in our streets, as we should say, upon our pavé, as you would say, any tokens.
The foreign gentleman, with patient courtesy, entreated pardon.
But what was tokens?
Marks, said Mr. Podsnap. Signs, you know, appearances. Traces.
Ah, of a horse? Inquired the foreign gentleman.
We call it horse, said Mr. Podsnap with forbearance. In England, Angleterre, England, we aspirate the H and we say horse. Only our lower classes say horse.
Pardon, said the foreign gentleman. I am always wrong.
Our language,
said Mr. Podsnap, with a gracious consciousness of being always right,
is difficult. Ours is a copious language and trying to strangers. I will not pursue my question.
But the lumpy gentleman, unwilling to give it up, again madly said,
Esker,
and again spake no more.
It merely referred, Mr. Podsnap explained with a sense of meritorious proprietorship, to our constitution, sir. We Englishmen are very proud of our constitution, sir. It was bestowed upon us by Providence. No other country is so favoured as this country.
And other countries?
The foreign gentleman was beginning, when Mr. Podsnap put him right again.
We do not say other. We say other. The letters are T and H. You say T and H, you know.
Still with clemency.
The sound is th. Th.
And other countries, said the foreign gentleman, they do ow.
They do, sir, returned Mr. Podsnap, gravely shaking his head. They do. I'm sorry to be obliged to say it. As they do.
It was a little particular of Providence, said the foreign gentleman, laughing, for the frontier is not large.
Undoubtedly, assented Mr. Podsnap. But so it is. It was the charter of the land. This island was blessed, sir, to the direct exclusion of such other countries as there may happen to be. And if we were all Englishmen present, I would say, added Mr. Podsnap, looking round upon his compatriots and sounding solemnly with his theme, that there is in the Englishman a combination of qualities, a modesty, an independence, a responsibility, a repose, combined with an absence of everything calculated to call a blush into the cheek of a young person, which one would seek in vain among the nations of the earth.
Having delivered this little summary, Mr. Podsnap's face flushed as he thought of the remote possibility of its being at all qualified by any prejudiced citizen of any other country, and, with his favourite right arm flourish, he put the rest of Europe and the whole of Asia, Africa, and America nowhere.
Jenny Wren.
The boy knocked at a door, and the door promptly opened with a spring and a click. A parlour door within a small entry stood open, and disclosed a child, a dwarf, a girl, a something, sitting on a little low old-fashioned armchair, which had a kind of little working bench before it.
"I can't get up," said the child, "because my back's bad and my legs are queer, but I'm the person of the house."
"Who else is at home?"
asked Charlie Hexham, staring.
"Nobody's at home at present,"
returned the child, with a glib assertion of her dignity.
"Except the person of the house. What did you want, young man?"
"I wanted to see my sister."
"Many young men have sisters,"
returned the child.
"Give me your name, young man."
The queer little figure and the queer but not ugly little face, with its bright grey eyes, were so sharp that the sharpness of the manner seemed unavoidable, as if, being turned out of that mould, it must be sharp.
"Hexham is my name."
"Ah, indeed,"
said the person of the house.
"I thought it might be. Your sister will be in about a quarter of an hour. I'm very fond of your sister. She's my particular friend. Take a seat. And this gentleman's name?"
"Mr. Headstone, my schoolmaster."
"Take a seat. And would you please to shut the street door first? I can't very well do it myself because my back's so bad and my legs are so queer."
They complied in silence, and the little figure went on with its work of gumming or gluing together with a camel's hair brush certain pieces of cardboard and thin wood previously cut into various shapes. The scissors and knives upon the bench showed that the child herself had cut them, and the bright scraps of velvet and silk and ribbon also strewn upon the bench showed that when duly stuffed, and stuffing too was there, she was to cover them smartly. The dexterity of her nimble fingers was remarkable, and, as she brought two thin edges accurately together by giving them a little bite, she would glance at the visitors out of the corners of her grey eyes with a look that outsharpened all her other sharpness.
"You can't tell me the name of my trade, I'll be bound," she said, after taking several of these observations.
"You make pincushions," said Charlie.
"What else do I make?"
"Pen wipers," said Bradley Headstone.
"Ha, ha, What else do I make? You're a schoolmaster, but you can't tell me.
You do something, he returned, pointing to a corner of the little bench, with straw, but I don't know what.
Well done, you,
cried the person of the house.
I only make pin cushions and pen wipers to use up my waste, but my straw really does belong to my business. Try again. What do I make with my straw?
Dinner mats?
A schoolmaster and says dinner mats. I'll give you a clue to my trade in a game of forfeits. I love my love with a B because she's beautiful. I hate my love with a B because she is brazen. I took her to the sign of the Blue Boar and I treated her with bonnets. Her name's Bouncer and she lives in Bedlam. Now, what do I make with my straw?
Ladies, bonnets?
Fine ladies, said the person of the house, nodding assent. Dolls. I'm a doll's dressmaker.
I hope it's a good business. The person of the house shrugged her shoulders and shook her head.
No, poorly paid, and I'm often so pressed for time. I had a doll married last week and was obliged to work all night, and it's not good for me on account of my back being so bad and my legs so queer.
They looked at the little creature with a wonder that did not diminish, and the schoolmaster said, I'm sorry your fine ladies are so inconsiderate.
It's the way with them,
said the person of the house, shrugging her shoulders again.
And they take no care of their clothes, and they never keep to the same fashions a month. I work for a doll with three daughters. Bless you, she's enough to ruin her husband.
The person of the house gave a weird little laugh here, and gave them another look out of the corners of her eyes. She had an elfin chin that was capable of great expression, and whenever she gave this look, she hitched this chin up, as if her eyes and her chin worked together on the same wires.
Are you always as busy as you are now?
Busier. I'm slack just now. I finished a large mourning order the day before yesterday. Doll I work for lost a canary bird.
The person of the house gave another little laugh, and then nodded her head several times, as who should moralise,
Oh, this world, this world.
Are you alone all day? Asked Bradley Headstone. Don't any of the neighbouring children?
Ah, lad,
cried the person of the house with a little scream, as if the word had pricked her.
Don't talk of children. I can't bear children. I know their tricks and their manners.
She said this with an angry little shake of her right fist close before her eyes. Perhaps it scarcely required the teacher habit to perceive that the doll's dressmaker was inclined to be bitter on the difference between herself and other children. But both master and pupil understood it so.
Always running about and screeching, always playing and fighting, always skip, skip, skipping on the pavement and chalking it for their games. Oh, I know their tricks and their manners,
shaking the little fist as before.
And that's not all. Ever so often calling names in through a person's keyhole and imitating a person's back and legs. Oh, I know their tricks and their manners, and I'll tell you what I do to punish them. There's doors under the church in the square, black doors leading into black vaults. Well, I'd open one of those doors and I'd cram them all in, and then I'd lock the door and through the keyhole I'd blow in pepper.
What would be the good of blowing in pepper? Asked Charlie Hexham.
To set them sneezing,
said the person of the house,
and make their eyes water. And when they were all sneezing and inflamed, I'd mock them through the keyhole, just as they, with their tricks and their manners, mock a person through a person's keyhole.
An uncommonly emphatic shake of her little fist close before her eyes seemed to ease the mind of the person of the house, for she added, with recovered composure,
No, no, no. No children for me. Give me grown-ups.
It was difficult to guess the age of this strange creature, for her poor figure furnished no clue to it, and her face was at once so young and so old. 12, or at the most 13, might be near the mark.
I always did like grown-ups, she went on, and always kept company with them. So sensible, sit so quiet, don't go prancing and capering about, and I mean always to keep among none but grown-ups till I marry. I suppose I must make up my mind to marry one of these days.
These extracts have been taken from the unabridged recording of Our Mutual Friend, read by David Timpson for Naxos Audiobooks.